learn a little bit about HTTP modules. I'm Chris Love. I am a web developer based in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I have probably built about 300 .NET sites in the last 7 years of various sizes. And along that way, I've had quite a few chances to leverage HTTP module technology to customize and enhance the websites that I've built over the years. And I just more or less finished a short Rocks Blocks, which is about a 20 to 30 page book that's available on Rocks in ebook format. It should be available to download in the next week or two. Right now it's finishing up the editorial process. But that Rocks Blocks is on HTTP modules. So today I just wanted to kind of go over a few of the things that I cover in my Rocks Blocks to kind of whet your appetite about what's in there and expose you a little more to HTTP modules. So today what I'm going to do is I'm just going to do about a 20 or 30 minute presentation and walk you through some practical modules that I've leveraged over the years, or at least some framework code for them. The first one being a background thread. This means we can run a process in the background of our website, whether or not we've got a web request going on or not. The next one is kind of a spam blocker module where we block bad IP addresses from accessing content on our website. And finally, the critical acronym is changing the content of the request before it's actually sent down to the browser. And that involves some really neat stuff that I came up with working on this book. So without any hesitation, let's get into some code. And the first thing I want to do is show you how to write a background module. So this one's going to be different than most other HTTP modules that you'll work on. Where this one originally came out of is I had a website need where I would need to synchronize with my client's third-party database inside their office to synchronize their updating during the day versus the database that the site was using locally. And there were certain business requirements for that. So what I did, instead of getting up every morning and hitting a button to synchronize the data or setting up an operating system level timer process to run every morning, because most people in a shared hosting environment don't have access to set system level things like system timer events. So in ASP.NET, we can write a module to take care of that for us. But what I'm going to do with my demonstration here is a real simple demo, is just to log the time every 15 seconds to a text file. So first thing I want to do is learn a little bit about how HTTP modules are actually written. And what we have to do is create our own class that implements the iHttp module interface. And that interface defines two methods that we must have in our class, that being the dispose method and the init method. The init method is where we initialize anything that we need to do. Generally, we're going to hook up to event handlers in the ASP.NET pipeline, and I'll show you how to do that here in our next demo. But what we get passed to the init method from the ASP.NET application framework is a reference to the actual application that's executing our website. So from that, we can get a lot of things such as the current context, the request, and the response objects that we'll leverage a lot in HTTP modules. In this case, I've actually defined two class-level variables. One, which is a string that actually references, in this case, the root path to our website. So I can keep that as a global variable so I don't have to reference it later on. And the next one is just a local thread class that we'll use to do our background process. So in the init method, the first thing I do is I grab the physical application path to our website so we can leverage that when we're building our background log file. And the next one is I create a new instance of our thread, passing it a reference to the log time method, which is a shared method in my background module class. And that method, every time it gets fired, which is when we run the start method on our thread, runs a simple while loop. Again, this is just a simple demo. And that while loop, what it does is every 15 seconds, it's going to just log the current time for us in a background log file. So I just use the my namespace since I'm a DB programmer by nature. and just make it write all text to a file and tell it where to put it, and then I put the thread to sleep for 15 seconds. So it's a very simple demonstration. But you could use this basic mechanism to do something like database synchronizations or pulling web data out of web services from other sites to update data on your website periodically. Think about doing an RSS feed reader, those kind of things. So this is a neat little utility. So let's go look at it in action. And I've already got a page ready to go for it. Honestly, all we have to do is just open up a page on the website. So we'll just open up the default page for the site. And what that's going to do is that init method is going to get called the first time any request is made to the website. And that's where our initialization of our module is going to take place. I don't have any content on this default page, but what's going on in the background is it's writing to our log file. Obviously, in this instance, you have to have write permission to your drive, so this may not be something you can do in your production or even development environments. But you can certainly do it in a local instance. So, what I can do is I can pull up our file right here, and you can see I've run through this and done this a few other times. And if you're familiar with Visual Studio, it's constantly watching the files that you have open. So every time one changes, it's going to pop up, and it's going to tell us that the file's changed and ask us if we want to update that or not. So you can tell today is March 6th, and I'm East Coast time, so it's 1:50. We're actually in Vegas, so it's something like 10:50, I think, out here. So every 15 seconds, it's going to keep popping up and annoying me with this. So this proves the concept we can run a background thread. And that will keep running so long as our site is actually running. Let me close that file so it won't get annoyed anymore. But real quick, let me show you the dispose method. What we want to use to do in the dispose method is essentially release any things we have open, resources such as file streams, those kind of things. In this case, I go close the thread by calling the thread.abort method and just clear it out of the memory. It helps the garbage collector work a little more efficiently when we can control these kind of things. Otherwise, the garbage collector is going to take care of it for us. So that's a quick run through of setting up a background thread. The next thing I want to show you is setting up a simple IP blocker to block spam. And when I say spam, that means hackers or just malicious content. Maybe it's somebody who's got something stuck in a loop that's constantly requesting your site. You want to try to check against those things. I'm not going to go into the sophistication of building a robust blacklist, but I just want to go into the mechanism of leveraging a blacklist to show you how you can block people from actually getting to your site and, A, draining your bandwidth and costing you money, or, two, getting to content that you need or want on your site available to people without them trying to hack at it and cause other problems. So, again, what we're doing in the init method, we're just getting a reference to our context there and setting that up. Again, I use the physical application path by default. But something, a new twist now in this one is an add handler. And in this one, I'm adding a handler to the authorize request event of the context. And I'm passing that, telling that it's going to the event handler is actually going to be the method check request. And this check request method will have two events in it. And, or two parameters passed to it. The first one being sender as an object, and the other one being E as an event args. We can name those variables anything we want to. This is a standard signature for event handlers in the .NET framework. So in this event handler, I'm actually calling another method I've got defined here called checkIP. And that's just a function that returns true or false. And if it returns false, or if it returns true, in this case, I'm going to use a little URL rewriting and just have it automatically bring up a simple HTML page that tells the person they're banned from my website. So in this case, any content they try to access on my page and they're coming from a bad IP address, that's the only thing they're ever going to get, they're ever going to see. So that keeps the bad guys out. So real quick, let's go check the check IP method. And again, I'm just going to use the my namespace to keep the code really concise. And I've got a data file set up with just a list of IP addresses that I put in here. And for demonstration purposes, I'm having to check the query string for an IP address that I'm going to pass into it so we can check to see if our basic mechanism, this function, works. And that's what I'm going to demonstrate here. So basically what it does is it checks to see if we've got an IP address, and then it's going to look at the contents of the file, and if that file contains the IP address, then it's going to return true or false. So this is a very simple check method. Obviously, for a real blacklist blocker and a website, we want something a lot more sophisticated. But let's go bring up the bad IPs database. And I've just put some random IP addresses in here. So if this just happens to be your IP address, please forgive me and let me know and I'll take you out of my blacklist unless you start doing something to hack it. So I'm going to go ahead and copy one of these out, but I want to show what it's like if it works. Again, we'll just open this up in the browser. Okay. So I'm coming from an IP address that I trust. So I'm telling you, you're coming from a good Internet Citizen IP address, and you can feel free to visit the rest of my website. So that's really good. What I need to do, let me go back and check my IP check. I want to get my query string variable correct. So in this case, all I'm doing is passing in an IP address as block, which I copied out of the data file. And so in this case, did I not do it right? Oh, it's IP check. I'm sorry. Something's not right. Did I copy it right? Oh, no. Ah, no, it's not it. Okay. Make sure I've got an IP address that's valid here. Let's go copy another one. Well, unfortunately, my IP address, I think, is not coming across correctly. But basically, you get the idea. Let's go. Oh, I know why it's not checking. I was reminded by somebody in the audience that I need to make sure the modules are configured to actually fire. Okay. So, HTTP modules need to be configured in your web config file to actually execute. Of course, with IS7, we can actually implement them at the server level, but let's look at this in the web config file. There's a section called HTTP modules that you can put into your web config file to define which modules are your custom modules are going to be fired. I also want to just make a little side note. Up here at the very top of my element, I've got a couple of child elements here telling me to remove some modules. Many times we're just using forms authentication, but if you by default, there's all three forms of authentication are turned on in ASP.NET websites. So that'd be forms, windows, and passport authentication. And all those are passing through HTTP modules. If you actually just remove those, your site should perform a little faster. It may not be really noticeable, but it's a good idea to remove the modules, the core modules that you want to be using. There's several others that you can actually dig into the web config file and pull out. I actually talked about this in the rocks box, so there's a good incentive to go buy the book. But what I did was I actually have the background module set up right now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and bring that out and set up my IP checker. And that should make it all work. So we'll just fix that real quick. There we go. So now my site should re-up itself. And there we go. Now I've passed it the bad IP address, and now it's saying you're coming from a bad Internet Citizen location. So you're not allowed to visit anything on my website. And I can change that to any URL that passes in that thing. So I could just make up a URL, which is a lot of times what hackers do. They'll sit there and make up URLs. So let's make a MixOA page. Page doesn't actually exist. But hey, they're coming from a bad IP address anyway. They're going to get the same content. So here, we block these bad guys. Okay. Enough of that. Now, one thing that's become near and dear to my heart over the years is trying to make the view state not get in the way so much. And a common trick that a lot of us use is to move the view state to the bottom of the page. We do this for search engine optimization purposes, making the page render a little faster, or sometimes we just want to show off to our friends. Generally, the way we've been taught to do this is to override the render method in the page class and do our own custom manipulation of that. Well, I finally figured out a way to do that using an HTTP module. And I think this is very significant with the release of IIS 7, because if you make a module that manipulates the content of your pages going out to optimize them, then you've got to build the ability to do this at the server level, not just a particular website. Or, say, in a page class, or a particular page that inherits from your custom page class. So as an architect of a system or an environment, now with IIS 7, you've got the resources to make this at the global level, and you don't have to put this burden on so many of your developers. And you refactor this down to a single source for multiple websites, which makes us a lot more efficient. Again, we've got the dispose and the init method that all modules must implement. And this time I'm actually going to put handlers in for two different events. And the reason we do this is we want to make sure we get the very last event that's fired before content is sent to the browser. And that way we're sure that we've intercepted it and we've modified it. Now, one thing that I learned trying to figure out how to manipulate the stream going to the browser before it actually gets to the browser is that you can't get to it in the response object. If you're not familiar with HTTP response objects, basically that's what's being built to be sent to the browser at the end of the processing or ASP.NET page. So I had to actually do a little trick, and that was to create a custom stream class. And I wasn't really sure where that actually was, but after a long, long day of figuring it out, I finally found that the response object has a filter property, which is actually the stream that's being built to be sent to the browser. And what we have to do is we have to create a custom stream class to process things for us. So if I just go to the class, the context menu will come up. Can I tell you what? Maybe. There we go. Twitter's down. How about that? Go figure. Okay. So, my optimized filter class just inherits from IO stream, and it has two private members. One is a just another stream, and another one is an encoding object. And I'm not going to get into streams or encoding objects, so that's not really pertinent to our discussion here today. But in the class instructor, I check to make sure, first I check to make sure we have a current context, because if we don't, we need to bug out. And if we do, we can keep processing on. What I want to do is just get a local reference to the response object here, and set the one that's our filter class or the stream class that's up there to what has already been built by the current ASP.NET pipeline. And then we also want to grab the encoding that has been used by ASP.NET to build this as well. And that will come in handy later on. I'm not going to get into the other things in the filter class because it's not really pertinent to the discussion here today. But you can override a lot of the methods to do things custom for yourself. Now, for what we're doing here today, we actually need to overwrite the write method and make it do what we want to do. So, first, I check to make sure we've got a filter, and if we don't, bug out. Next, we use a stream builder to go grab the content out of the current filter that we have, the encoding stuff, and build a stream I call HTML here. And then I'm going to run it through my algorithm to, in this case, move all the hidden input tags, or grab all the hidden input tags out of the HTML stream. And I'll just stick them back in at the end, right? So if you're not familiar with regular expressions, I do encourage you to go do that. That's another whole day's worth of, or 2 days worth of discussions, which we obviously don't have time for. I better shut that application off. Okay, so basically, regular expression is a little programming syntax we can use to match patterns and strings. And in this case, what I'm doing is I'm looking for hidden input tags, and I'm just going to run it through a for each loop and check all the matches that come up in our content being sent to the browser that is a hidden input tag. And the reason I go after the hidden input tags is it doesn't matter where on the page those sit. They're not going to be rendered out to the user in the browser, but they need to be there in the browser. The view state is a hidden input tag, and it can be quite large at times, especially if you're very efficient with your programming, you can see a very bloated view state. So what I do is I go through and I just run a replace transform over the content based on the match and to replace that with an empty string. So in other words, I'm pulling it out of the content and I'm putting it into a local variable called HTML right there. Okay? Or pulling it out completely. And I'm pinning it to my string builder. That way I've got it at the end. So down here at the very bottom of the method, I can create a new string called output and just run a simple replace operation on it and look for the closing form tag for the form element. And I just replace that with all of our hidden input strings and another closing form tag. And then I've got another little regex thing to go through and try to strip out some of the white space that's left at the top. There's going to be some artifactual white space set up there. So that's another little regex expression to run over the final content you're going to send down the browser to kind of strip that out. What you'll find is you'll see like a space at the very top where we pulled out all these hidden input tags. And so finally, what we're going to do is we're going to write out all the content to the string we got locally in our class, and that's going to handle sending stuff down to the browser for us. So what I've got here is I've got a little demo, and we're going to run it without setting up a module to respond, and then we'll run it with a module actually in the process here. So get the right one up here. We'll open it up. And I'm just putting together a real quick stupid page with a bunch of letters on it and a button. Okay. And the significance of that is we want to check out the view state. Okay. So we've got a little view state up here. It's not very big. It's not very bloated. Not a big deal in this case. But you can think about it. If you use a grid view or some other things with a lot of controls on, you're going to get a very bloated view state. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at this now and reload this page. But after we've set our module to work, so what we want to do is disable the old one, set the new one. I'm just doing this just so we can make sure we're doing we've got the differences going on here. Okay. So now, when I reload this page, we look at the view source. Notice that our view state's not at the top of the page anymore, but rather down the bottom along with a few other, with another hidden input tag, the event validation hidden input tag. So it's a really neat trick to figure out how to manipulate the content in your web server. If you think about what you can do with the content before it sends to the browser. If you're familiar with the front-end performance techniques, some of the things like moving all your JavaScript to the very bottom of the page is a great way to make your page render a whole lot faster. Another way you can use regex expressions to move stuff down to the bottom of the page. Maybe you've got content that you want to replace. Maybe you're trying to stop vulgar words from going out over the internet. Maybe you can put a vulgar word filter in there, catch everything that goes out in case you don't control the content that people are publishing in your site. That'd be the case in a lot of social sites or comments on a blog, things like that. So, I hope you've enjoyed a little run through of some things you can do with HTTP modules. And look forward to the book coming out.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
These are really cool modules. I could see how these modules would be useful for not only ASP.NET applications, but PHP or static files even.
Right.
Can you use these modules with those types of content as well?
Okay, so the question was, can we use HTTP modules with stuff besides ASP.NET? And the answer is, yeah, we can, with IS7, certainly. Or if you've got a site that's got a web config file, I don't know if PHP and web config stuff will work together. I haven't gotten that far here. But yeah, if you put the HTTP module at the front of any IS7 module pipeline there, that will run over all the content going out. So anything that's processed by the ASP.NET pipeline essentially will be processed by all these modules. So think about it, if you want to guard images, is another example of something I've done in the past. Image hijack, and you can check the request and who was where the request was originally initiated from, that kind of thing, and stop people from hijacking your images. So I've done those kind of things in the past. So yeah, modules can work with all different stuff. So yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier that moving the view state to the bottom, that technique is good for SEO. Can you explain a little more how exactly is it relevant to search engine optimization?
Okay. So the question was, why is moving the view state relevant to search engine optimization? And I'm going to sum it up real quick. Search engine spiders generally only consume the first higher portions of your web page. And I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I saw a study that basically, and it was about 2 or 3 years ago, so I don't know how this has morphed and transformed. But say, I think Google actually leveraged the first 110 bytes of content on your page. Yahoo would say 150 on the MSN Live was something like 180 bytes. After that, things didn't really seem to matter. And they had an actual belly scientific test, in my opinion, to kind of prove that that was the way the algorithms were working at the time. So view state can get really big, and it's going to be at the top of the page. And so all they're doing is indexing you on a bunch of other base 64 encoded characters. It's not going to help you get ranked for those great keywords to make business happen. And I think that's one of the reasons, in my opinion, that .NET websites don't rank very well in search engines. I really do. So, yeah, so moving things to view for the model for search and optimization for a public site is probably a very optimal thing you want to make sure you do. So, are there any more questions? Okay, real quick, just for a wrap things up, I want to go back over to the PowerPoints and finish up. Like I said, the rocks block should be due out very soon. It's actually in the portal phase. I've got another rocks block that will be falling right up on its heels on HTTP handlers. So you'll see some more cool stuff like that. I also did a GeekSpeak back right after Thanksgiving this past November where I went through and did HTTP modules and HTTP handlers. So if you go to Channel 9, you can pull that down. And my blog is professionalhpnet.com, and I put all kinds of goodness stuff up there. And last December, my first book came out, ASP.NET 2.0, Your Visual Blueprint for Developing Web Applications, which obviously focuses on ASP.NET programming techniques. I've got a few things in there on handlers and HTTP modules. If I remember right, I go through and walk through doing URL rewriting with an HTTP module. So, if you have any questions, hit my blog, send me an email, and I'll see if I can point you in the right direction. Thanks a lot.